Welcome to the Words That Change Lives podcast, helping leaders, coaches, and small business owners to 10 times the impact of their message. Join us as we delve into the art of powerful language, enabling you to speak with unwavering honesty, communicate authentically, and create a lasting impression with every word. In this episode, we have another head-to-head, and this one is called Eyes versus Ears. And I am speaking to the awesome Shiggy Pachter. Shiggy is a multi-talented entrepreneur who found her niche in helping business entrepreneurs find their online voice through various audio assets, thus founding Audiophy as the playground for audiobook, podcast, and other audio content production. She's got a background in sound engineering spanning over 20 years, twinned with a love for the theatrical. With the help of various clients over the years, she's now created her own Redline method that allows business authors to remotely record professional sounding audiobooks ready for Audible, private hosting, or any other kind of online utilization. She's also a pretty awesome professional DJ. She loves Brazilian jiu-jitsu. She is a coach. And her idea of downtime usually involves spending hours rock climbing. I've known Shiggy for quite some time now. We've been in the online world for a number of years. We've met in real life a number of times at various events. And Shiggy was the best person I could think of to talk about this topic of ears. And I'm coming at it from the eyes perspective. And really what I wanted to explore in this episode is where our eyes and ears play in learning and absorbing and enhancing the words that we use. So how does audio only enhance the impact of our words? And how does visual enhance the impact of our words? I'm very much coming at this from a public speaking viewpoint and a training perspective. When I used to stand up in classrooms, I always had visuals to help anchor learning. There's a certain use of slides in public speaking to enhance the experience. And Shiggy's coming at it from the ears perspective in terms of real enriching audio experiences, the future of audio, and what we can think about and how we can use audio to our advantage. So let's dive in. Hello, Shiggy, and welcome to the Words That Change Lives podcast. It's so great to have you here.
Hi, Helen. Thank you for having me. It's been a while.
It has. It's really great to speak to you. And so just as a reminder for listeners, we have different types of episodes on this podcast. And this particular episode is called A Head to Head, where we look at a topic around words, around your area of expertise. And this one is called Eyes versus Ears. And of course, we're going to unpack that a little bit more. And I think the best place to start with that is all about you, finding out about you, because audio has really, really featured in your career in many, many different ways. And you have many, many skills and talents around the power of audio. So what are some key moments that have really influenced your love for audio?
Let's start with when I was a little baby. And English wasn't my first language. So I know if you listen to me right now, you're like, oh, she sounds like she's American. I'm not American. I'm Kenyan. But, you know, when I first existed in the world, English was not part of my lexicon whatsoever. I spoke fluent Swahili up until the age of about 5 or 6 years old. And then with my parents, my stepdad came into my life and he speaks English and a bunch of other languages. And my first kind of understanding of the importance of language, like audio, I was obsessed with music. I've always been a creative music, whatever person. So that's one thing. But when it came to like linguistic processing, I had a bit of a disadvantage when I first moved from Kenya to England and everyone spoke English and I didn't. You know, so I didn't really care. As long as I was with my mom, I didn't really care. And you're going to love this because all I really relied on was body language to start off with. But what I also relied on was intonation, you know, even listening to music. I'd listen to a lot of English music, but I wouldn't know what was being said. Like my favorite artist from the age of, I think, 3 was Prince.
And good choice.
I mean, it's a good choice, but he says some naughty, suggestive things, right? And yeah. I knew nothing. So I think literally from the time that I started learning English at the age of, 5 or 6 years old, I was already starting to understand the process of language, having to learn English from a second language point of view, but to a very high level, clearly, kind of gave me the opportunity to understand how you say things and what they mean. So I embodied that quite a lot. And then coming into what I do now, honestly, it was a very nonchalant kind of like, yeah, I have the skills and obviously everyone should do this, but they don't. So I guess maybe I should help people think in, what was the first time? I think 2018 was the first time I was initially pulled into the area of spoken audio assets. Mm-hmm. As opposed to music, because I learned music technology at university.
Can we just take a few steps back there? Because first of all, I can imagine going from Swahili to English. That's an incredibly different language in its composition. Mm. And so what you're saying there is that the way that people were saying things was what you picked up on. Mm-hmm. And then I'd love to talk about your music because obviously I really connected with you over music and DJing, and obviously it's just a hobby for me, but you go out there and you do your thing, which is absolutely incredible to see. You look fantastic. You look amazing. Please remind me the name of your DJ name again.
Yeah, it's going through a transition at the moment. It was so many things. It was Neopink, but now it's Nuodroid.
Love it.
Is what it's changed into.
Yeah. So you studied music at college?
I've been playing musical instruments. I played the cello from the age of 6, and I play 7 musical instruments. And then I started studying music technology, not music, at A-level. So from the age of, I believe, 16, 17 is kind of when A-level start. So I did.
And what was it back then? What was the technology?
It was hardware mostly. At St. Bede's, we had a music technology hut, which is kind of cool. We had lots of MIDI equipment. So kind of keyboard controllers. We had a huge outmix desk, which was great. It was a Mackie. No, it was a Fostex. Sorry. So if anyone is younger than, I suppose, a 90, 97, oh my god, a 97 baby or something, I'll say Fostex and you'd be like, what? So we had a Fostex mixer with a Fostex hard drive recorder, so we would do multi-track recording on the mixer, so all our instruments would go in through the back of it and then it would go out onto this little hard drive in a rack,
right?
And a lot of people would be like, if you're a musician or musically inclined producer, and I'd be like, oh yeah, I saw those in my software, and I'm like, no Hardware.
Yeah.
That's what it was. It was a lot of live music recording. The group that I was with, it was mainly dudes. I think there was me. I was mainly the only music tech focused female. There were 2 other ladies who would come in and pop in for music tech, but they did it for recording their instruments. But I was a tech person, and through that I also learned how to live monitor a jazz band, our school's jazz band as well. So that was my first kind of like touch into my sound engineering kind of career. And then I went to Brunel University and studied creative music and technology. I didn't realize it was creative music and technology.
Okay. So it was a heavier lean on the creative music.
Yeah. So my instruments had to come out in full force. And I was just like, I didn't come here to play music, although the improvisation stuff was great. Learning a time signature. What was the time signature? I think it was 10 over 14 and a half, which was crazy as a time signature. So yeah, a lot of learning in there. I know I glossed over that initially, but yes, I am very musically inclined. I started DJing when I was studying A-levels, because I was at a boarding school, and Disco Dave wasn't really selling it. His music taste was limited.
I can imagine.
So me being the cocky little 17-year-old that I was, I'm like, I could do better. Bear in mind, I have never touched vinyl or CDs or any DJing aspect ever. It's just me and my friend Stanish. We were music tech buddies. We just hang around a lot. and he had vinyl and he played trance. And I was like, I'm going to learn to DJ over summer. So I did. I begged my mother to get some CD decks because I knew vinyl was going to be too heavy, at least with CDs. I already had a huge CD collection because I love music. And she pawned her car. She pawned her Volkswagen Jetta that she just bought for these decks. Yeah. And she's like, you had better get the money back for this, you know. And obviously I have, plus change.
Yeah, what an incentive.
It was. And I learned from a book called How to DJ Properly, which I think should be the Bible for everybody.
I didn't know there was such book.
Yeah, it's I still have it. I should have brought it down. I still have it with me. Like, it's literally how I learned to DJ. There wasn't YouTube in 2003, right?
No.
It's when I started learning.
That's when I started learning. 2003, I bought Technics and Technics 1200s.
There you go. So you're way more advanced than I was when I started. I started on CDs, and then I learned how to DJ on vinyl at university. After blagging my way into a job as a sound engineer, I had no idea what I was doing. Like, I just made my CV look really sexy. And they're like, yeah, sure, this sounds great. We'll hire you. And I'm just like, I don't know what I'm doing.
Amazing.
So yeah, that's just the beginning part. I'm not going to go into the whole thing because we'll be here forever.
But that then, obviously, the trajectory off there, you've moved into digital. From CD, so I skipped the CDJs. I had a huge gap where I didn't do any DJing at all for like 10 years. And then I got my Traktor,
yes.
Got my little S2, and I got the S4 a few years ago and loving that. But so you carved out a career in DJing.
Yeah. It still is and always probably will be my happy place because it's a conversation again, right? It's a conversation through music where people feel sounds that make them feel a certain way. Most of the time it's happy, you know, or emotional, or like, you know, if, like being a fellow trance baby when Adagio for Strings plays and then you just got that euphoric trance was great. I don't know what happened to it, but that's not a conversation.
I know. I first started mixing trance. That was the first records I got.
I did jungle. Because obviously I didn't want to go on like easy level. I wanted to go on expert mode from the beginning. Not even drum and bass, just straight up jungle where you got chopped up almond breaks.
Yeah. So, I mean, I could talk to you for hours about
separate
that.
Separate episode.
Yeah, separate episode. So where did that then led you? And you labeled it up really nice and I can't remember what you said, but it's into then the more, the world of using your voice through audio in a number of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So what did that look like for you and how did that kind of happen for you? So you went from, you did sound engineering. When did you cross over to actually using your own voice?
So honestly, between like 2004 up to 2018, my sound engineering skills were basically for live music. And just like monitoring that and, you know, making sure the microphone sounded good, making sure the front man sounded great, making sure the in-ear monitors had the right feed of whatever people needed on stage and stuff. And then the misogynistic nature of that world, I was just like, you know what? I'm done. Bye. So honestly, it just turned into my own personal hobby of like, I use Logic. I've used Logic since it was PC-based. I think it was Logic 2 and still owned by eMagic. And I used Cakewalk initially, which a lot of people would be like, what's Cakewalk? It's free now, but it used to be like the daddy of DAWs, the digital audio workstations. So honestly, it came down to a point where we were in an entrepreneurial group and a friend just posted, you know, hey, I've got these audio files that need to be turned into an audiobook. Can anyone do it? And I was just like, give me the files. What the hell is this? And I started to do it for free because I honestly was just like, what is this? Genuinely, like, what is this audiobook thing? Because I've been a snob the entire time up until this point. I'm like, audiobooks are done by Penguin Publishing and it has to be done in like a professional studio. And like the sound engineer needs their personal rack of like EQ things and all this, da-da-da-da-da. Literally, you know, the elitism was there. I mean, I had the elitism with podcasts as well. I still have a bit of an issue with podcasts, but we won't go there just yet. But yeah, like being in the music audio space as these things were coming in. Like podcasting to start off with was a really expensive hobby. Like what we're doing right now didn't exist in 2006. You know, it was very, very basic and very kind of like geeky and nerdy, and only like the elite nerdists who were radio people would do it, not us. So yeah, that's why I ignored it for the longest time, because I was just like, I felt my skill set as a live monitored sound engineer didn't really have a place. And then all the stuff I did digitally in Logic or Ableton or whatever was just something I do just to mess around. I really didn't kind of value the skill set I was nurturing up until 2018. So I got given these audio files for free, and they were horrendous. Like, they were recorded, I think they were recorded in Thailand, and there was like emergency ambulances going in the background, motorbikes, children screaming, people having arguments, you know, all kinds of things. And I worked with it. I didn't have what I have now as far as the digital rack of software that I have that I can literally just like slice through audiobooks like in a fraction of the time. So it took a lot of time, a lot of work to do it, but I did it, and I was just like, ah, this is a thing. And said friend was just like, oh, well, that was great. And it went up onto Audible, and it's still there now. And he was like, do you want to make it a business? Because I was coming out of another business. And I was just like, I guess. He was like, go on then. And that was it.
Wow.
So yeah, that's what it came. It came from just literally a Facebook post from a friend.
And how has that unfolded? So what sort of things are you doing now? What sort of projects, what types of things?
So it's been quite interesting in the sense that between that time and now, I did have a little flirtatious time with podcasts. So I spent a lot of time. I mean, lockdown was strange for everybody. Lockdown was probably the most profitable moment for me with Audiophile, because everyone is at home and they're like, I want to do audio things. And I'm like, you've got Amazon Prime. Let's get you a microphone and like figure stuff out. Yeah. So lots of podcasts were done, which was interesting. But now I feel like my interest, my creative focus for podcasting means I'm not as aligned with it. So I've kind of decided I don't really do the whole editing and promoting and podcasts, because I am creative in the sense of assets, like audio assets. How do we muscle this audio asset into something that is of use, you know, not you've done it and then you forget it. So I started designing a podcast archive searching database.
Okay.
So people can search with keywords to find parts of their podcast that refers to certain things. That's been 3 years in the making, and I'm still designing it because I'm not a programmer, and it's very, very labor intensive. So that's one aspect. And then courses, you know, making courses sound great, creating or using the podcast platform as an e-course offering for people.
I get you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's nice to notice that the e-course platforms have finally caught up, because I was looking at this in 2020, and like now things like Thinkific, Kajabi, Katra, and all of those things. Was it Kotara? I can't remember. But they're finally offering private podcast options within their apps.
Aha, yes.
Which is a beautiful thing, because if people want to learn from whoever as they go, and the entire course is in there, then they can kind of access it on their phones or on their computers or whatever, which is great. So I've been looking more into the creative audio asset space. But then audiobooks are definitely still my bread and butter, because, you know, we're in a similar space where if you are the face or the brand of your business, you know, whether you're an entrepreneur or a solopreneur or whateverpreneur or freelancer, whatever you want to be, if you're the face of it, you're going to be the voice of it, you know, and that voice is going to be on stage. And that's kind of one of my prerequisites I have for audiobook people, is that they either aspire to or have stage experience.
Aha.
Because then it makes their vocal presentation more exciting.
Oh, that's really, well, that is an amazing segue into
let's go.
What I want to talk about next, because as you said there, so a part of my business, not all of my business, but a part of my business is helping people to do that on the TEDx stage, on keynote stages, on corporate stages, to be able to deliver an articulate talk in a way that is compelling and makes an impact and incites some type of inspiration, motivation, or action. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a skill to that. And when people are giving talks, there is audio, of course, there's sound, and how people are receiving that information is really important. Mm-hmm. But a lot of things that I work with my clients on is how we are using visual anchors as well to enhance the impact of what people are saying. And of course, you know, there's many situations where someone's just had a mic and absolutely slayed, you know, just had made such an impact with just a mic, but still they've got their body language. The audience are still watching them. And in the days of my learning and development career, everything that I did was focused on a trainer helping people to learn with other things that are going to anchor that learning. Mm. So this is the eyes part of this head-to-head. What's your experience of that and opinion on that? You've already said that actually it's a prerequisite for anybody who's doing an audiobook mm. with you to actually have had that stage experience.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's interesting with the whole book and audiobook aspect of businesses is whilst I would love to work with only people who have done stage speaking kind of things, I do allow room and space for people who are aspiring mm-hmm. because if as and when I kind of go through them and I speak to them, I can kind of pick up on whether they will be great for recording their audiobook or maybe they shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know?
I'd imagine you've got to have that honest conversation, right?
Yeah.
Because some people don't have a voice for radio.
No, it's true. I mean, a great example is like between us, we both have our own cadences and intonation styles. All right. Yours is more kind of engaging and capturing and like, you know, it's very upbeat and inviting of questions. Whereas I'm kind of, I think it's just because I haven't had my coffee yet, but I'm more kind of, you know, as a matter of fact, hitting statements and hitting bullet points that are very much pulling your attention. So we're both pulling attention in different ways. Mm. So I do have experience in the sense that I studied Lambda and I did Lambda okay. as a child. Wow. And I think I got a distinction. I can't remember.
Amazing. It was,
eons ago, we are old. And you know, with that, see, like just little characteristics. Everyone's got their characteristics, but people don't lean into it. So I studied Lambda. I studied drama at GCSEs, but I think I was a little bit too left wing for it.
Okay.
Just because I love doing philosophical monologues at the age of 16, clearly. And
that's just so awesome.
Seneca at the age of 16, it makes sense. But yeah, beyond that, I think I am just a very creative person. So I enjoy the emotions of the voice. Mm-hmm. But like you say, I think I did a keynote speaker thing last year.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that. That looked amazing. That looked so good. How was it?
It was terrifying. But it wasn't. So it was terrifying, but it wasn't because I just decided to be my very ridiculous, silly self. So I wore my tuxedo top, which is backless. I wore my impossible orange skirt. And it's called the impossible orange skirt because no matter how you photograph it, it never looks the same as what you see in person because it's got a pearlescent tint to it. So sometimes it looks red. Sometimes it looks deep orange. Sometimes it almost looks white, but it's just high orange. I wore knee-high high school socks and Converses. So, you know, and I think, I also have my hair in bunches, in pigtail bunches, because I just needed to break everything from people's like visual aspect, right?
I get it.
Visually coming onto the stage, I had my tuxedo, which is tails on it, and then I took it off halfway through my talk. So for sure, in person, when you're on stage, there is a huge physical visual performance element.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say if you are audibly flat, but visually kind of entertaining, you will lose people, you know, because they'll be like, oh, it's a shiny, flashy thing for a little while. But then after a while, they're just like, okay, so what am I trying to get from here?
Great point. The words you use and the way you use those words are huge. So there is that saying of, oh, you know, the, you know, body language is 58% of, you know, and the words we use are just 7% of the impact. I don't agree with that.
No.
You know, what you say and how you say it make up a vast proportion of public speaking. And then the visuals for me are just, are an enhancement of that. They're there to enhance. If you're using any type of slide, it's got to take your audio, your words to another level rather than you using them as a crutch or a support, because then it just turns into a presentation.
Exactly.
And you get lost. I'm just imagining it. I'd love to actually see, if I can see that talk, I would absolutely love to see it. So what you were wearing was a kind of visual disruptor.
Mm-hmm.
Did you use slides?
I did, but they were like the most basic things. I literally threw them together the night before. Mm-hmm. And my whole talk was just basically the art of living life tenaciously. Just because of my life experience and all the stuff I've been through, I was invited just to talk about that. And it was my first keynote stage talking experience. And I know I realized I was too raw in my delivery. I only say that because there's the aftermath that people don't talk about when people come up and talk to you and then they trauma dump on you. And then you're holding on to that and you're just like, did I say something wrong? And you're like, no, okay. I didn't say anything wrong. So that's a whole other story. But yeah, basically the way I delivered it was with the inspiration from Trainspotting and the Choose Life poem. You know, so I had that initially, and then I used Gary Vee is like, you know, F what other people think, you know. Mm-hmm. And just basically kind of running through my life story very, very quickly. It was a speed run through my life because I've been through a lot.
Yeah, you have.
But just delivering something that was on par with like a stand-up comedy show, because mm-hmm. I even used some stage engagement, just with my friend Adil was in the back corner. And someone else who was a brand new friend, she just like called out something at me. And I immediately just like called back. It was like a heckle, an instant heckle. And we spoke about that. It was a bit of an African kind of African mother versus a daughter type of thing that was there mm-hmm. to educate the audience. So being able to take that on board, I think for me was a great learning curve, because I realized like, yes, audio is one thing. Yes, speaking is one thing, but engagement is another thing. So you've got the visual, but then you've got engagement. A lot of people on stage, I've noticed, don't like to engage with their audience. They're terrified. Like if someone heckled them, they'd probably absolutely fall apart, you know, which is fine. Yeah. Some people do fall apart, but
yeah,
I enjoyed it.
It's interesting because one of the other head-to-heads I've done is public speaking versus stand-up comedy.
Ooh.
Yeah, and this sort of conversation was going on, but engagement, yes. Obviously, with the drama training, the background training, it's breaking the fourth wall, mm-hmm. right? It's breaking that fourth wall to go on a dance with your audience and have them to go on that dance with you. And with TED Talks, that's actually less of an option.
Mm.
So the talks are, you know, short, they're 15 minutes long, and there's less opportunity to engage. Whereas a keynote, which is longer, there's loads more opportunity. And you're right, it's not just about audio, it's not just about visual, it's also about breaking that wall and engaging with your audience as well. And you don't actually have to have engagement from your audience to engage with your audience.
True.
But it adds another dimension to what you're saying. It's, I think we're agreed here, it enhances the impact of your words.
Absolutely.
So let's strip it back then, and let's go to ears. So obviously this is, you know, this is your absolute area of expertise.
Yes.
So what does audio only do
that
visual doesn't do?
So do you remember when you were a kid? I don't know if you ever had this. I think this was just me because my parents traveled a lot. I used to listen to the Beatrix Potter stories.
I did.
On tape.
Yes.
Right? I have my own cute little teal colored like baby boom box thing, right? And at night
with
the headphones, and I would listen to the stories, right? Bear in mind, I had the entire collection as books as well, right? Yeah. But I always preferred listening to the stories. And I know audio dramas are a little bit different because that kind of leans, actually, I'm going to mention it leans further into creating stuff in your head,
mm-hmm.
right? Because the music, the sound foley, you know, the rustling of leaves versus the crackling of fire, you know, kind of it elicits feelings out of you, right? Mm-hmm. And then you create the visuals or don't. You know, audio gives you the option to either create your own visuals if you are very visually, you exist in a more visual space.
Yeah.
Because everyone has, I think there's three different learning styles. So you got your audio, your visual, and your kinesthetic.
Kinesthetic, yes.
So if you're visual first, then you will probably be really good at visualizing. So mm-hmm. listening to stuff only means you can visualize stuff that is good for you or makes you happier, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So listening to Harry Potter books to make it a little bit more relevant because, again, we're old. So making it, we're not. It's just, you know, you say Bridget's Potter to some people and they're just like, what? I'm like, the bunny rabbit. I'm like, well, hen? And just like, fine, Harry Potter being read by Stephen Fry. Okay. Which is my level of, you know, mastery is basically listening to Stephen Fry's recordings because they are beautiful. But listening to that elicits whatever emotions through your visual field or through your kinesthetic field. So if you feel a certain way, you know, hearing a thunderstorm with rain pattering on the windows whilst it sounds like you're indoors next to a cozy fire, right, mm-hmm. is gonna, like, even saying that, like, I feel, you know, a little bit warmer.
I feel it too.
And that's because you can hear it. We're all very familiar with those sounds. Mm-hmm. So that familiarity will kind of create spaces that you can not really get as much when you're already visually force-fed things.
Right. It's interesting because as you're talking, I'm thinking, gosh, yeah, I am so visual, so I am like majority visual. And I love listening to things. I used to love listening to the stories. I love listening to podcast docuseries. And the visual element, I'm thinking about it, I'm listening to one at the moment. I am visually conjuring images in my mind as I'm listening.
Mm-hmm.
So there is still the visual element there, right?
Yeah.
And for other people, the feeling is going to be more dominant. But I know that for some people can't visualize at all.
No.
They don't actually have that ability. And so the auditory track, the way that the audio is coming in is the main thing for them. But I think what you're saying there is, regardless, there's still something else that's created from that audio experience.
Yeah. I mean, if we're going to go down, you know, the route of people who don't see or feel from audio, there is still another aspect, which I don't think is really kind of very much spoken about, is a processing style. Where it's literally, if someone says to someone, like, you know, do 2 times 2 divided by the square root of 8 or something, right? If it's written, that person will just be like, I can't do this. If they hear it, then mm-hmm. they know the answer, you know? So mm-hmm. I was terrible at mental arithmetic, okay?
Me too.
And I'm a visual person. I can see, you know, the cosine of blah, 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 whatever. Mm. And I can see Pythagoras' theorem in, you know, my mind's eye. I'll be damned if I can do anything about it. You know, mm-hmm. if it's written down, then like I can, you know, I can scribble things down and da 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 da. But some people work a little bit differently where they're not visualizing a maths problem or whatever data they're being given. It's just going straight into the processing part of their brain and they immediately understand it. So for certain styles of audiobooks, as an example, I've done a lot of property investment audiobooks. Which is weird. Like you look at me and you're just like, yeah, she probably does like inspirational stuff. No, property investment is the biggest asset I've had so far. And what they talk about, you know, if you're in that space, the stuff comes off the tongue so quickly, like it doesn't really bother you so much. You already understand what they're talking about. You don't need to visualize, you know, exponential ROI on an REITs property or whatever. I don't know what that means. but I hear
good though.
I hear it a lot. You know, I could fake it till I make it. But you know, some people just hear that and they're just like boom, 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 and they understand it already. So the delivery from an audio aspect to them is quicker than having to read it. So
yes,
yeah,
yeah.
That's another aspect.
Yeah. And there's another point there. I think nowadays people, there's two types of people with regards to listening and watching, because a lot of podcasts now are available on both. You can watch them on YouTube as well as listen to them on podcast platforms.
Yes.
And a lot of people I speak to watch podcasts. I don't do that personally, because when I'm listening to something, I'm usually doing something else. Mm-hmm. I'm usually tidying up or like doing other bits or walking or exercising or something like that. Whereas a lot of people like to watch podcasts. But I guess with the audiobook, it's either you're reading the book or you're listening to the book.
Yes.
Right.
So what experimental assets is something, again, I think I mentioned at the beginning, like, you know, I lean more into creative kind of things. And something I've noticed, this is more for my personal interests, is, you know, you support your various like audio narrator kind of people on Patreon or whatever, is doing live streams of your recordings. I enjoy, like, I don't, like you, I don't really watch podcasts. There's a few I will watch just because I love the aspect of being the third person in the room. Mm-hmm. There's not many podcasters who do it, but some podcasters who break the fourth wall, I really enjoy, because they always do it on a beat. You know, They'll be like, da 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 da, and then you should really do this. And just like, me? I don't know what you're talking about. You know, which is great. Again, it's you know, stage engagement, but it's through a podcast.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed, you know, as evil as TikTok is, there's certain narrators I follow on there, and when they do a live stream, like, they'll, you know, tell you when it happens, or even on Discord. So you sit there and they're recording their audiobook or whatever they're recording. And the secret about audiobooks is when they're recorded, time doesn't exist. You know, you can record your last chapter at the beginning. You can record your first, like, there's no linear nothing, right? So even when you're recording a chapter, you can record, you know, your first 8 paragraphs or whatever, and then pause and have a chat with people who are watching the live stream and ask them what they thought about, you know, the tempo of the chapter so far, if the voices worked, da 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 da.
Wow.
Right? And then you get feedback, and you can be like, if you're really chill about the time it takes for you to finish something, you can go back and re-record something based on the feedback of your listeners who are going to listen to your book when it's finished. But they be in the live moment of something being created, much like when you're doing a book, you promote it and you invite
people. Read along.
Yeah, you do a read along, you invite people to your email list, and you're just like, here's extra stuff that you like. Same thing for audio. Granted, it's a little bit video based, but same.
Okay, that's really interesting. So what about the future of audio? Yes. Where are we going with it? And what do we need to consider in terms of how we absorb words and learn and be inspired from them and take action from them? What's coming up?
It's interesting. AI is very, very much here. If you reject it, then you are going to fall behind. Mm-hmm. I don't like calling it AI because it's not really artificial intelligence. It's just ML, which is machine learning, because that's what it is. But I'm pedantic like that. Always have been, always will be. But machine learning audio is here. It's doing a lot of stuff. A lot of people are freaked out by it, but you either adapt or die. So I was toying with Descript's create your own voice option in 2020. I was about to say 2002, but that's too far back. 2020, during the pandemic and stuff, I was already looking at, you know, how fun it would be to have my voice, a cloned voice that can narrate my essays for me in my voice. I then realized that my voice is way too kind of like all over the place for AI to be able to do that. So it's a safe bet. Okay. But now it's gotten so much smarter within three years, you know, 4 years. Now, you know, there's people talking about like fake Drake songs or fake artists, you know, songs coming out, because now you can emulate voices really, really well. So that's something that's coming in. I would highly, highly suggest not embracing, you know, taking a fake AI voice and using it for any of your audio assets.
Right.
All right. So as great as it is all coming in, definitely don't try and replace yourself, because that's literally what will survive You know, in this AI world, you being a face front business, you need to use your voice as much as you can, right? So then you are a voice out there. You know, when people hear your voice, you hear Gary V. Like, who else can be Gary V but Gary V, okay? Mm-hmm. Even if he AI'd his voice or whatever, right? Which he probably will and will hate it. But, you know, he'll use it for certain things. But, like, the in-person experience is always going to be different because those intonations that we have are going to disappear with AI voices. Mm-hmm. So there's that aspect. Editing audio has become so ridiculously easy. Like right now we're on Riverside, and I remember when Riverside started, it had issues. It had a lot of buggy, crashy issues. And now it's great. Same with Squadcast, which is my preferred platform. They've been bought by Descript, right? So Descript now owns them, and what they're doing there is crazy because you can do video editing and podcast editing and refine the audio in one click. You know,
yes, with a premium thing. I've seen, you know, there's this, they call it the AI transcripts. Everything's, you know, they're using AI.
Exactly.
To pull everything out for you. And
and it's great. And I love it. But, you know, the speed of execution means that there's going to be a lot more trash out there, which is fine. It has to happen.
True.
Which means, again, your voice is super important in the myriad of trash coming out. So,
yeah, let's talk about that. Are you able to share a little bit about that in terms of the focus that you've got on that
type of thing? Yeah. So I kind of hinted before that, like, I've kind of let go of the world of podcasts just because unless you look at the long-term plan with your podcast, which goes beyond, like, if it's beyond your business now, do you still want it to be around? Like, you have to pay for hosting. You have to pay for certain things and stuff. Are you going to pay for that indefinitely? If not, then make it something that can stand the test of time. You know, YouTube, in all honesty, just upload it to YouTube, it'll just stay there forever. But, you know, the second you stop paying for your podcast, it disappears. It becomes driftwood in the podcast space. I've gone back to old podcasts and they just don't exist anymore. You know, the metadata and everything, the RSS feeds are still there, but it's a husk. You know, ghost ships are everywhere. So that really frustrated me when I started looking at that. I'm just like, people aren't thinking long term with that, which is why I really encourage the idea of, like, private podcasts or have them behind an email list. You know, Hello Audio is probably my favorite platform at the moment, where I think they work with Thinkific now. And I'm not plugging any of these. I have no commission or whatever. I just like what they do. Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, if people pay to be on an email list, that email is then attached to the podcast access that they have specifically, and they can access your podcast privately on their chosen platform anyway. So Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, which is dying, you know, again, like, big example, Google Podcasts is just killing it off because they're obviously got the YouTube thing that they're focusing on. So I just feel like that space, much like our social platforms, which are dying a death at the moment, it's, again, it comes back to having an email list or having something that you can control fully.
That's yours.
That's yours. Even though there is software out there that, you know, kind of can help you, just be wary that nothing on the internet is permanent. So with whatever audio stuff you have, if you can host it privately, that's great. If you can host it with some software that's around for a while, that's great, but always have your own backup. AI is going to make a lot of trash out there, which would just devalue a lot of things, but then also mean that stuff that you focus on that is your own voice will increase in value if you can position it properly. So that's the main things. Like, your voice is so important, whether it's on stage or whether it's online. Doubly, triply so online because of what's coming.
That's really, really insightful. And nicely wraps up this episode of Head to Head with Eyes versus Ears. Shaggy, it's been so awesome to talk to you. I've actually learned a lot, and I'm buzzing. It's been really, really great to talk to you. And with all my guests, I ask them one final question on the Words That Change Lives podcast, which is, what words have changed your life?
This is going to sound so cheesy, but honestly, it's very meme-erific. It's cool story, bro. If you've never heard that phrase, it actually goes on. The whole phrase is, cool story, bro. It needs more dragons and shh. That's the whole thing.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it the thing I love about it is, you know, I'll say cool story, bro, when it comes to a situation that I've deemed is not really worth my time to engage in, which is a lot of stuff. You know, the other version, I guess, the other more PC version is it is what it is, but that's a little bit too passive for me. What I like about cool story, bro, is that it's like, I acknowledge what you're saying, but I really don't care.
That's exactly. I say it a lot to my child.
it is of that generation, to be fair. Like, you know, if you want to communicate, you know, respectfully what you're saying, I hear it, but what am I meant to do with it?
Yeah.
You know? Cool story, bro. And you move on. And they're just like, either they get offended or it's a case of like, oh man, I really just said something that was really not useful to anybody.
Yeah, you know, and it's good learning for that person.
Good learning. So cool story, bro, for me has been great in diffusing a lot of situations and just reminding me life is too short to be angry at stuff. So
I love that.
Cool story, bro.
I love that. And for anybody listening, I'd love to hear what you think. What do you think about this topic? What's inspired you? What are your thoughts on cool story, bro? You can email at hello@helenpakham.com or you can share online using the hashtag words that change lives. Thanks so much, Iggy, for coming on today. And I look forward to speaking to you all next time.
Thanks for listening to Words That Change Lives. Please rate, review and follow on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really means the world and helps me to reach more people so that we can all harness the power of our words and change lives for the better.